next speaker is Cyrus.
Cyrus.
Little incursion into biology.
Hi, Cyrus Armin from Berkeley, and I'm going to shift gears for a moment and talk. Am I playing automatically? Yes. Sorry. Don't want my slides going. I'm going to talk about some work I did for my PhD at Berkeley, studying spatial patterns of gene expression in the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster, and then I'm going to talk about a number of common list libraries that I implemented to actually do this work, and then I'm going to finish with a few words about my experiences doing this and some of my views for the future of Lisp. So, a brief introduction to Drosophila. There's a picture of one up there. It has a nice small genome, about 120 million base pairs on four chromosomes, with on the order of about 14,000 genes. And many of these genes are dynamically expressed in space and time. And now we have tools like DNA microarrays that allow us to measure which genes are expressed in, say, an entire fly, or a fly embryo, or a fly larva, in parallel for all the genes in the genome, essentially in one experiment. But the problem with that is it doesn't give you any spatial resolution about where these genes are expressed. It doesn't tell you the precise spatial patterns or the precise times that these genes are turned on and off. So in order to do that level of detail, you have to really look at these genes one gene at a time. So the tissue that we're studying are known as imaginal discs, and imaginal disc refers to the fact that their primary purpose is actually to form tissues that are active in the imago or the adult fly. However, we studied them in the larval stage, so a small number of cells are basically reserved to form what are called these imaginal discs, and then they go on to form things like the legs, the wings, the eyes, very important tissues, obviously, for the adult fly. But in the larval stage, they're not actually doing much for the larva. They're kind of set aside and growing internally and getting ready to form the exoskeleton of the adult fly. And here's a picture, the structures, the numbered structures on top, 1, 2, 4, 8, 9, 10, and then down below, are a representation of what the imaginal discs look like in the larval stage. And then the big thing in the center is, it's actually much smaller, but that is a representation of the fly embryo and where these tissues are in the embryo. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what these things look like and what they're going to go on to become. And then I want to just quickly read this quote because I think it really says a lot about the nature of these imaginal discs. So, the information required to organize, pattern, and to control growth appears to function as an autonomous developmental program in imaginal discs. So what that's saying is that the discs themselves and the cells within the discs really have all the information that they need to control the development and patterning. Now, this is perhaps a slight stretch, but much genetic work has been done to demonstrate that really the information that controls this program is inherent within the cells in the imaginal discs. And this quote is from Stephen Cohen, actually. It's in the classic book by Bate and Martinez Arias is over across the river. But anyway, the project goals that for this project are to, one, build a catalog of the spatial patterns of gene expression of a large number of genes, to be able to perform meaningful comparisons between the disks and the patterns within the disks, and then to be able to cluster and classify these patterns of gene expression. So ideally, we were going to do this on a really large number, say 10% of the genes in the genome. We actually did more like 150 genes, but we're doing some more, and hopefully one day we'll have a more complete catalog. This is some of the input data, if you will. So these are images on the top row of wing imaginal disks, halter imaginal disks on the next row, leg imaginal discs on the next row, then halters, and the eye antennal discs down below, and then isolated eye fragments. And I don't know how much contrast you have, but you should be able to see that some regions of these discs are blue, which means that they're stained for the presence of an individual gene, and others, where there's no dye, that means that that gene is not expressed at levels that we can detect. So, given those images, we didn't want to have to manually score these images, so obviously we want to teach a computer how to do it. So the first task was to segment the foreground from the background of those images. And in some ways, that's actually fairly trivial, too, because you can just use a local detector, say the variance at a given pixel, local variance, and you can measure, you can find where the biological foreground material is. But the problem with that is that there's a lot of noise in here. So bits of the trachea and other parts of the fly larva kind of stick to these discs. There are other discs in frame. There's other things going on. So if you just take a very simple threshold to segment, you're not going to get very good answers. So we wanted to come up with an automated method to do the segmentation. The first thing to do then was to figure out some sort of way of representing the shape of these imaginal disks. Now, obviously, we could just draw it by hand and say, this is what an eye disk looks like. Or we could take a single exemplar and say, okay, this is a canonical disk and we're going to use this one. We actually wanted to learn the shape from the data. So to do that, the first thing we did was manually segment a number of training examples. I hate to admit it, but I actually used a little Java GUI tool from the Berkeley Computer Science Department to do this, unfortunately. Would have been great if there was a nice McClim application I could have whipped up, but McClim wasn't at that stage then. And so there's also some good examples of what these things look like up at the top, and then their segmented outline down below. And these are all wing disks, but you notice there's substantial variation in kind of size, shape, orientation of these disks. So we needed to correct for that, and simultaneously we wanted to learn shape of these imaginal disks. So we used this method known as congealing, originally developed by Eric Lerman Miller, and the idea is basically take all the images in some orientation in a stack, and you basically just adjust the image in the stack one at a time until the stack gets better, and basically until the stack stops getting better, where the measure of goodness is pixel-wise entropy. So essentially you have a set of affine transformations where there's one affine transformation for each image, and you tweak the parameters of those transformations over and over, basically do coordinate descent on those transformations. And eventually you will get to a reasonably good answer where the pixel-wise entropy of the stack is minimized. So I have a little Common Lisp library for doing this. The question, you know, that's kind of the hand-wavy description. The problem, of course, is, well, how do you figure out what those affine transformations are? And so it turns out that you can just start with the identity transform and kind of tweak the parameters one way, you know, go up, make it move down, or stay the same. You just keep going, iterate through the stack until it converges or until you get bored, and you get reasonably good answers. I'm, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip to some examples. So here we have wing disks on top, legs, halteres, eye, antennal disks, and these are prior to alignment with congealing. And this is after we do the alignment with congealing. And you see there's still some variation from disk to disk, but overall they're much more similar. And for example, the third one on the top row was at much smaller, actually it was much smaller because that image we took at a lower mag, but I threw it in there to see if the congealing would actually correct for that, and it does. But the other nice thing that we get out of that is, aside from just the disks that are now aligned, we get these shape models. So you can treat essentially the average pixel intensity of the stack as a representation of the shape, if you will. You can threshold it, and you can say that, you know, everywhere it's above a certain value, that's kind of the overall shape, or you can use this grayscale. I don't know how well you can see it with the contrast, but near the edges you can see a slight blurring of grayscale. And that's just a measure, if you will, of where the variation is within the disk. So it's actually kind of a nice tool to be able to see where the variation is within the models. So then, given that shape model, we wanted to, we wanted to go back into, we did the learning of the shapes from a handful, say a dozen, two dozen manually segmented examples. We didn't want to have to do too many of those. But we had 1,000 images, and so the challenge then was to go back, use that shape model to then identify disks automatically in those other 1,000 images. So what you see here are the results of a similar procedure where you start with the shape model, you go into a new image, and you find the disk, and then you find an affine transformation that aligns that disk best to the model, and the only way to really explain it in the context of this slide is that the blue is a representation of what I had to do to the original image to get it to align well with the model. So like that middle one on the bottom row, basically we had rotated a little bit this way and stretch it this way and shift it around. And you can't really see it, but I'm sorry for the fact that the contrast isn't showing it, but what you should be able to see is that the foreground of the disk is shown as variation in the blue channel here. The red is the shape outline, and then the green are the areas of stain. So the next step, obviously, is to go through and automatically score for stain. This gives us a representation of stain for these individual genes. So these are all different genes across the top. We have CG555 and CG747, etc., etc. And here's the same thing for halter disks and some sample ion channel images. And this is nice, but this is kind of the next step in the processing, where we take these individual images, and this is a data point, if you will, for this particular gene. Then the next step is when we have multiple data points from the same gene to build a consensus map. So these are consensus maps of five different genes in the wing and then five different genes in the leg, where we see these spatial patterns of gene expression. And a couple of things to notice are that one, many of them are rather different from each other. They're characteristic, so they're conserved between different replicates of the same experiment. And if you happen to know something about the developmental biology, it would be consistent with what you would expect, say, decadent collegiate DPP, the second one on the top, to look like with this nice characteristic stripe. So we're getting data that's consistent with what we would expect and consistent across multiple experiments, and it looked reasonably good. And here's some more with halters and antennal disks, and we see these nice patterns. Some of them, again, have these characteristic patterns where there are genes that are expressed in particular parts of the developing eye. The eye has this bit called the morphogenetic furrow that kind of moves across dynamically over time. And we're seeing two genes that are expressed behind the furrow, and then another one that looks like it's being expressed right at the furrow in this SPN43A. Okay, and then the next step is to take those maps, if you will, and then we can cluster the maps, and we can make cluster centers of the individual maps. And this, I thought it would be more useful than it was. It was kind of nice in that we would pull genes together, but it's interesting to note with only 150 genes or so, you could do this by eye pretty easily. So it's nice that the computer can do it, but it's not a huge win because you could do it manually. Where things got a little more interesting, this is a little harder to do by eye. You can still do it with really characteristic patterns, but as you get more and more patterns, you don't really want to have to do it by eye, and two, sometimes you find things that you wouldn't otherwise find. So what I'm showing here is a reverse lookup procedure where we have a query image in the upper left. We take that image and we apply the automated alignment and stain scoring routine, and we see that it's expressed in those two little bits there, and then we go back and we search the database for the five nearest patterns. And you can see it found this SP558 that looks fairly similar, MP1, DR, and you can kind of see why it picked those, and it looks better if you were just to take five random genes out of the set. These obviously look much more like the CG3132. So the reverse lookup in the image seemed to be working.
5 minutes.
Thanks. Wow, I'm gonna hurry. Okay, so then the next thing we'd be doing would be to take multiple patterns and construct these virtual overlay maps where we can see the relationships between these patterns in the same image. But where things got interesting with the clustering was not so much clustering the patterns themselves, but actually clustering the pixels. So if you think of making a vector at each pixel where the expression of each gene at that pixel is the vector that you then do your clustering on, this is just a simple k-means clustering, you get this really interesting pattern where nearby cells, essentially, it's pixels, but you can think that there's correspondence between sets of pixels and sets of cells, and they cluster together, and they cluster together in ways that if you know the Drosophila biology are particularly interesting, where you see cells that are separate in space, but ultimately are going to have similar functions, like the top of what will become the wing and the bottom of what will become the wing are actually very similar tissues morphologically, and they have similar profiles based on the genes that we were able to image here, and that comes out in this pixelized clustering. So that was very nice. Let me quickly mention the tools that I use to do these. These are all open source. Most of them have been released, and the ones that haven't been released, if you contact me, I'm happy to do so. But I built a matrix library called Clem. Why would I build a matrix library when you would think that that had been done before? Well, I got into this and I really wanted to use Lisp, and I just couldn't find anything other than using raw arrays that really did the job for me. So I built this library. One thing I could have used was MatLisp. And MatLisp is very nice. But the idea there basically is that everything is a double float or a single float. And I had a lot of bit masks and grayscale images. And I wanted something, I had done some work in MATLAB, and I wanted something that allowed me to deal with typed arrays without having to convert everything to a double float and then back to a bit mask or what have you. And I really liked the Lisp type system, so I wanted a library that essentially would let me do matrix operations on typed arrays. And so Clem has a closed hierarchy of various specialized arrays. You can have essentially an unspecialized array where it's a value t, or you can specialize and go to unsigned byte 32 or complex or what have you. And there are slow or generic versions of all the standard matrix arithmetic operations that operate on the unspecialized matrices. But where I felt the need, I would go through and use macros to generate specialized methods that would take, say, do a matrix multiply of a double float matrix times a UB8 matrix and output a double float matrix. And that in SVCL proved to be very productive and allowed me to get fast matrix operations that didn't use a ton, didn't cause up a bunch of memory. And there's this nice operator called with typed MREF that allows me to essentially declare the type of an object without, it would have been great if I could say, declare type unsigned byte 8 matrix and have the compiler do the right thing and just be able to use some standard function. But it turned out in order to do that well, I didn't want to have to cache the value of, I didn't want to have to go and say, okay, get me the array that actually holds the data for this object and then do aref on that. I wanted to abstract that away. So I used this with typed mref, and it actually essentially compiles down to an aref, but it made my code a lot cleaner and yet still allowed me to do essentially type declarations for my matrices. Thanks. The next package is GCC XMLFFI that I use to automatically wrap a number of libraries from the .h and or .c files for those libraries. And that generates SBAlien, which is SBCL's foreign function interface output. Originally, it generated UFFI, and in theory, I could do a CFFI backend, but I haven't gotten around to it. It's kind of similar to what is now known as Verizano, but that wasn't enough when I needed it, so I wrote that. And then on top of Clem, I built an image processing package called CHImage, so all the images that you saw were all processed with CHImage. It has operations for convolution and blur and sharpen and all that stuff, morphological operations, affine transformations. And it's all relatively fast, and it's all in Lisp. So obviously, you could do this with FFI to ImageMagick or plenty of other libraries. But I like the fact that I could extend this and write the code directly in Lisp. And I can get text with FFI free type, etc. I'm going to skip over this stuff. And on the way over here, bear with me for 2 minutes. On the way over here, I was reading John Maeda's Laws of Simplicity, or his new book on simplicity. And he had these 10 laws, and they just seemed really profound, not so much in general, but really in conjunction with my experience with Lisp. So I wanted to go through them and say a couple words. The first was reduce, which, we all know that. It was so important. They named a special function after it. So that seemed like the Lisp guys, developers, picked up on that one from the get-go. Second was organization. And obviously, Lisp is a big beast, and it's really important that we have and continue to have an organization both of the language itself and of the libraries as it moves forward and as the community hopefully grows. Second is time. And again, this was so important that they named a special function after it so that you can measure how much time your code is taking. But one of the things that I found, I was really obsessed with, well, first of all, when I started writing Lisp, I didn't really care how fast my code was, and that was great. And then I got really obsessed with making sure that things didn't const, and I had type declarations all over the place, and I'd lie to the compiler with the, and you know, I would do all these things to get things working really fast. And now, you know, maybe I have the advantage of my core stuff that I really need fast is fast, but I find that the most common declaration I use these days is debug 3. So I kind of, you know, did this whole circle where I really got obsessed with performance, and then I found it was like, how can I reduce the overall amount of time I spent on things, not so much how fast my code was. And learning definitely makes things simpler, and when I look back on my initial attempts, the early Lisp code I wrote, it's kind of a big mess, and it really takes a few years, at least for me, maybe some people pick it up more quickly, to really get comfortable with writing decent, clean Lisp that you're comfortable showing others. Okay. One of the other beauties of Lisp is that it works well at the high level and the low level. So I thought, you know, the simplicity and complexity need each other spoke to Lisp's ability to, on the one hand, represent laugh, and on the other hand, represent really high-level semantic knowledge about the world, etc. Context. I took this to mean that Maida was a big fan of asynchronous interrupts and liked the fact that we had signal context and used those all over the place in our Lisp implementations. I don't think that's what he meant, but could be. Lispers are very emotional about Lisp, and I think this is a good thing, but we have to channel it in the right direction. One more thing. Trust. This means don't lie to the compiler. Let the compiler do its type inference. Don't use the place. And we should trust the compiler, and the compiler should be able to trust us. Failure, I think we need to take a Darwinian view of Lisp, and not everything is going to work. And it's been 50 years, hopefully there will be another 50 years, and there will be successes and failures along the way, and we really need to recognize the failures, get rid of them, but have the strongest ideas and concepts continue to survive so that Lisp doesn't become completely static for the next 50 years. I think when he wrote the one, he meant Lisp all the way down. Finally, three keys away. I don't need to tell this room about the benefits of abstraction. And I do think that for Lisp, openness really is important. And we've seen, you know, publications, and then we saw standardization, and now we're seeing more and more good, completely open Lisp implementations, and this is a trend I hope continues. And then finally, I think this means do less, or do more with less code. And I think Lisp is a great tool for that. So let me just thank these people who worked on the project with me at the Brinkley Just Hot Legino project and in the EECS department at Berkeley. Thanks.
Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to save the questions for the coffee break. Otherwise, we're going to be late.